Twisting in the Wind. Like at most county fairs, there are always people there, including this one here, trying to promote a product and or service. And occasionally there are people who are there to entertain us with some sort of gimmick, correct? Personally, I have really enjoyed at the Norfolk County Fair a performer by the name of Bandolini. There he is. Oh, right there on the picture. He is incredible, that guy. Yeah. Now, one such presentation that I heard about at a county fair was there was a carnival barker who got out on stage and shouted to the passing people to gather around for the most amazing demonstration. And when he thought a sufficient crowd had gathered by around the stage, out came from behind the curtain a huge man, a man rippling with muscles, kind of like me. Anyway, this huge, muscly man took the stage, and he stood right next to the MC. The MC stood aside as that muscly man began to lift big, heavy barbells, and he even lifted the back end of a tractor. This guy was really strong. And the crowd clapped in appreciation for his strength. Then the MC pulled off his hat, and out of his hat he took a large, juicy orange from his hat. He handed it to the muscle-bound man. The man then proceeded to squeeze the orange, squishing out streams of orange juice. And the man squeezed and squeezed until there was nothing left but a mass of dried-out pulp. And then the MC said something very bold. He said, "I'll give $1,000. To any person who can come up on stage and squeeze out just one drop of orange juice from the pulp that's left." Well, there was this excited murmur that went through the crowd, and soon several very strong farmers, both men and women, rushed up on stage to give it a try, but no one could squeeze anything out of that pulp. Finally, when all the people who were there had given it a try, or had it made the attempt, there was a very skinny, bespectacled man who put up his hand and said he'd like to give it a try. Well, the crowd sized him up and they kind of chuckled that this little skinny guy could do it. If all these very strong, farmer-like type people couldn't get anything out of that pulp, how in the world is this skinny little man going to do it? But fair is fair, right? So the MC called him up on stage to give it a try. The slightly built man clambered up on stage. He took the pulp and gave it a squeeze. And surprisingly, several drops of orange juice came dripping out on his hands. The MC and the crowd were absolutely stunned. They gasped in surprise. "But how?" stammered the MC. "You must be amazingly strong for your size." "Oh, not at all," the man said. "I just happen to be an auditor from Revenue Canada." Come on, that's a good one. You know, I was thinking about this strong man squeezing that orange when I was reminded of an experience that I had many years ago when I was a teenager, and I went with a bunch of friends from church to a joint youth group that was held for a while between Queensway Baptist Church, my home church in Brantford, and First Baptist Church, Brantford. And the leader of this particular joint meeting, which was held at First Baptist Church, was a student minister by the name of Lloyd Hurlburt. Some of you might even know him. And during the devotional time of this gathering, he asked a question that provoked one of the liveliest debates I have ever seen in a youth group. And I've never forgotten that moment. For some reason, we were discussing what being masculine really meant, when Lloyd suddenly asked us this powerful question: "Was Jesus manly?" Now, to be perfectly honest, none of us were really sure how to answer that question. And Lloyd pointed out that our hesitation to be definitive in stating that Jesus was manly was, he believed, the product of all those years of Sunday school and VBSs and hearing the stories of Jesus that depicted him as meek and mild. Now, those are comforting images, don't get me wrong, but it also accumulated to make Jesus seem kind of soft and cuddly. At times, even coming across as kind of a doormat for the religious leaders who stepped all over him. So I'm going to wonder today, or I'm wondering today, how do you answer that question? How do you picture Jesus in your mind, in your heart? Now, I cannot prove it, but I suspect that one of the reasons so many men struggle in their spirituality, even if it's politically incorrect to say so, is that they perceive Jesus as soft. Even the famous portrait, there it is there, that hangs still in a lot of church basements or even in hallways, has Jesus portrayed like an airbrushed supermodel selling hair care products. And so one of the reasons I think that these last few weeks that you and I have journeyed through together in the book of Matthew, why it's so important to look at these passages. Because the image here in Matthew is that Jesus is anything but soft. In Matthew 21, verse 12, Jesus clears the temple. That's not soft. He also aggressively and somewhat cryptically defends his authority to teach and heal. Several times he uses parables and he tells stories that are in a subversive way that are a kind of ideological weapon against his opponents. I see Jesus quite often as kind of like poking the bear. Then when they challenged him with tricky questions regarding the law, taxation, about the resurrection, he turns that whole discussion around on them and he leaves them speechless. That's not soft. If nothing else, the lesson here is that what we need to be very cautious about is picking and choosing stories about Jesus that depict him as being just one-dimensional. That yes, Jesus was and still is very welcoming. He is friendly. He's forgiving. He does provide nurture to hurting people, but my goodness, he's much more than that. As we have seen over the last few weeks, Jesus has demonstrated that sometimes in this life, there are things worth getting worked up about. Things worth arguing about. Issues that call on us to be forthright with each other, especially as well as being loving. Especially when it comes to causes like justice and righteousness. I suspect that one of the reasons we hesitate to think of Jesus as being assertive, and yes, maybe at times a bit hard, is that we really don't know how our ideas of Jesus mesh with our ideas of love. We erroneously think that being people of love or doing what Jesus would do means grinning and bearing injustice, prejudice, and sin because we think that's the loving thing to do. In other words, we suffer in silence or we allow others to suffer in silence. The reality is, therefore, that we have this twisted sense of what it means to love God and to love others. Because right in the heart of all this confrontation, Jesus states that the most important thing is what? Love. Clearly, Jesus sees no contradiction between what he says and what he does, and his call to love is in the heart of it. So it appears we really do not understand what love really means. At least the way Jesus talks about it and the way he lives it out. Now, we all know in our culture, we throw around the word love as kind of a synonym for like, right? We say things like, oh, I love chocolate, and frankly, who doesn't? But anyway, we say we love a boyfriend or a girlfriend because they make us happy. We love our spouses because, in the words of Jerry Maguire, they complete us. In all these things, there is a common element, isn't there? Emotion. The kind of love is a very passive kind of love. In these encounters, which we describe as love, we sit back and we wait. We wait to see how we feel about that person or how we feel about a particular thing. And we either feel affection or we do not. That is why couples ridiculously talk about falling into and falling out of love. Have you heard that? The love Jesus is espousing is not at all passive. And it's not strictly emotional either. You know, in the Bible, I don't know if you know this, there are many references to love, but here Jesus is being specific. He's quoting Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5. The Bible is clear. He says that God chose to love Israel above all the other nations on the earth and to express his love to them. It was an act of God's will to love them. To love God in Deuteronomy is to choose to love God. And feelings aren't really a part of that equation. I know many of you people have been in churches for a while. You've heard all kinds of talk about agape love. You've heard that word before, that Greek word. We've probably heard sermons or been to Bible studies where the difference between philia, which means brotherly love, that's where the word Philadelphia comes from, or eros, which defines passionate or sexual desire. Agape's different. Those two, philia and eros, are hardly ever used in the New Testament. But agape, it's all over the place. Even though there might be some emotion connected to agape, it's not the defining nature of that kind of love. Another way to understand it is by calling it loving kindness. It's active mercy. It is marked by generosity. It is a choice, not a feeling. This helps us understand today's text a lot better. Because if we think loving God is an emotional thing, we will always come up short. I mean, how can we even begin to conjure up feelings for someone who's so mysterious and who at times even feels remote to us? And this brings me to one of my concerns about Christian music. And I'm not a music critic, so don't take it for what it is. And there's a problem with some of this music, at least in my mind, more exclusively to contemporary music, but not all. Quite a bit of contemporary Christian music has intentionally within it the desire to elicit emotion. Emotion for God and Jesus. You've probably noticed this. If you listen very carefully to some contemporary Christian music, you could replace the names of God and Jesus with your sweetheart's name. And it would still make grammatical and musical sense. Sometimes when I hear those songs, it feels like I'm trying to woo God or romanticize him. And I understand how this comes about. I do. There's a lot about God in Christ that is beautiful, that is heartwarming, that is incredibly touching. It is hard not to be moved emotionally by the powerful stories and even our worship and experience with God, probably even today. And that's okay. That's quite okay. What should concern us is this. Can we love God and our neighbor when we don't feel like it? When we must overcome our feelings and simply ignore those feelings to act with mercy to someone. In this discussion, there needs to be some honesty and frankness, doesn't there? There are, as we all know, times when loving God as Jesus calls us to is extremely challenging. Maybe, dare I say it, almost impossible. Maybe in our brokenness or when we are beaten down by life, we question God's goodness and wonder why we should even bother to try and love Him. But again, we almost always strive for feeling love, not agape. We think our love for God should just happen, right? As it should for our neighbors, that we can just be passive about it and let it just happen. True love of God and of others has an intentionality attached to it. For example, what parent out there has felt 100% of the time loving towards their child? Maybe you've heard this story. There were two men who were sharing coffee at a local coffee shop. And one of the men proceeded to talk about how much grief his son had been causing him. The young man was getting into so much trouble. It was keeping up the father at night. The other man replied, "Well, if he were my son, I'd have tossed him out of my home by his ear or on his ear." To which the other man said, "Well, if he were your son, I'd have done the same thing." "But he's my son, and I love him." That, my friends, is intentional love. Love that is a product of the will. A love that is evidenced in an act of mercy. How many times have we known someone whose spouse or children are making their lives hellish, and we wonder, how can they put up with that? You already know the answer, don't you? It's agape. You see, when our actions are equal to everybody, whether they make us feel good or not, we are beginning to love God and neighbor as Jesus intended. This is not easy. Not easy at all. But you know what? It wasn't easy for God either. Israel, time and time again, sinned and broke their covenant with God. Time and time again, God forgave them and reconciled with them. God gave His all as an act of love, namely Jesus, right? So, can we find those that we meet that we find dirty and repugnant because the Pharisees couldn't love them? Can we love them? The challenge of Jesus' words comes when we recognize that as Christ's followers, we often use love as an excuse to a path of least resistance. When confronted with the need to express mercy to someone, we think Jesus permits us to say, "Well, not today, I'm not feeling the love." Instead, Jesus is calling us to a love that leads to excellence in life. Love, as Jesus presented and called us to, keeps us from being hypocritical. You know, in James 2, 15 to 16, we read these words. "If a brother or sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Go in peace, keep warm and eat your fill,' and you do not supply their bodily needs, what is the good of that?" The problem with our interactions with other people begins with the fact that we often relate to others by considering immediately what we personally need, what they can do for us. This is so ingrained in us that when someone approaches us, we often say what to them? What do you want? Our appreciation and our interest in other people is often predicated on what they can do for us. Consider what Jesus said to the man who hosted him for dinner in Luke 14. This is what Jesus says. When you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors. In case they invite you back in return, you'd be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. How soon we forget that God created us, not because he needed us, but rather because he wanted us. Think about that. He made you and I and everyone else for the sheer love of it. Mike Mason points out something very powerful, at least I think so. He says this, strictly speaking, I do not know that I'm needed in this world. It seems to me the world could carry on quite well without me. Would it make any difference if there was one less star in the heavens? No, that extra star is there not because it was needed, but because it was wanted. And knowing I'm wanted by God and by other people is more mysterious and more freeing than feeling that I'm needed. It is far better, Jesus is telling us, to want God and to want other people rather than simply needing them. Can we want a person who is economically disadvantaged? Or someone who's broken in spirit and who cannot in any way, shape, or form give anything that we need? Examine, therefore, Jesus' interaction with those that the Pharisees did not want to have anything to do with. The Bible's full of them. Zacchaeus, one of my favorite stories, had nothing Jesus needed, nothing. In fact, reaching out to Zacchaeus was costly for Jesus. His reputation was going to take a terrible beating, but Jesus didn't care. Because Jesus wanted Zacchaeus. Because Jesus wanted Zacchaeus, in turn, Zacchaeus wanted other people, didn't he? Remember how he said, if I've defrauded anyone, I would pay them back four times the amount. I'd give away half my money at least to the poor, if not more. You see, if Jesus had had feelings for Zacchaeus, but that wasn't what motivated him at all. It would have been horrible for us, you and I, if God's love to us was predicated on his feeling good towards us. Oh my, awful. In the first epistle of John, we read, God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in them. You know, I hear so often, maybe I've said it myself, that people just don't understand God. I get that. There is an unfathomable mystery about God, isn't there? The truth, however, is that if we wish to understand more about God, we must dwell in his presence. And if we want to dwell in God's presence, then we need to be people of love, agape love. In loving God and our neighbors, we know and are known. There is no other way to deepen our faith and to experience abundant life than this. Amen.